This program is sponsored in part by the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatments, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Epilepsy Foundation Florida leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies to stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com/Florida to find out how to get involved today. Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolios strive to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a neurologist that practices at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, hoping you get the medical answers you want. Coming up, have you noticed that you're seeing nurse practitioners or physician assistants more than your doctors lately and wondered why? Then, we'll talk to an alternative and integrative medicine practitioner for some advice on how to stay healthy at home this holiday season. But first this hour, we'll find out what doctors, healthcare experts, and patients think about whether your doctor or provider needs to look like you, the patient, in order to receive better care. Let's talk about the racial makeup of our doctors in America. According to the American Association of Medical Colleges, despite black men and women making up roughly 13% of the U.S. population, only 2.9% of the entering medical school class in 2019 and 2020 nationwide are black men, a value less than when Jimmy Carter was president. Black women fare only slightly better in this analysis, with 5.2% of enrolled medical students nationwide. Here in Florida, the statistics are comparable. According to the 2018 report on that physician workforce from the Florida Department of Health, 5.4% of doctors were African Americans, representing a 1% increase over the past decade. Hispanic doctors represent 17.2% of all Florida doctors, a roughly 3% increase over the same time period. So how does this impact the care patients receive? Here now with more on the subject are two terrific experts. Dr. Swapna Reddy, a professor at Arizona State University and an expert in health disparities and policy, and Dr. Maisha Robinson, a neurologist and palliative care doctor at the Mayo Clinic here in Jacksonville. To Dr. Reddy and Dr. Robinson, a good morning and thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
It's great to have
you
both.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Dr. Robinson, I'm going to start with you. As an African-American doctor, what are your thoughts on why there are so few black doctors in America? And more importantly, why does it matter what race or gender your doctor is?
You know, to answer the first part of your question, I think there are a number of factors that contribute to the low numbers of black physicians in this country. You know, we can start thinking about our public school systems, particularly in minority communities. They often lack resources to prepare children for college, and there's a lack often of emphasis on the STEM courses that will prepare people for pre-med trajectories. And then I'll have to tell you, even though I went to college at an Ivy League school, the well-intended advisor for pre-med courses actually discouraged me from going to medical school. And I don't think that's an uncommon scenario. I have an identical twin sister, and both of us were told that we should consider different professions. Thankfully, we didn't listen and had other support and are now both physicians. But I think that happens and that's a deterrent. And then I think we know that there are biases as well in undergraduate and medical education admissions committees, not to mention the cost of education. And so you ask, why does it matter? Well, we also know that there's this kind of immediate sense of connection when a patient walks in and sees that his or her physician is of the same race or even of the same gender. But more importantly, I think The literature has suggested also that there are health outcomes that can be tied to race concordant care, improved health outcomes. You know, there was an article recently talking about black babies tend to do better when cared for by black physicians.
Wow. And by the way, I'm amazed about that discouragement that you got. Dr. Reddy, on a different point but related, you know, you're a national expert in health disparities and policy, and you're also of Indian descent. So I guess my question to you, does your doctor need to look like you to produce that better health result that Dr. Robinson just mentioned?
Yeah, it's a great question. And to Dr. Robinson's point, you know, we have plenty of literature in this space that supports the idea that when there is concordance, so really the idea that a physician or healthcare provider is from the same race, ethnicity, religion, cultural background, community as you, as the patient, right? That's the concept of concordance. When there's concordance, we not only have better health outcomes, so those are measurable kind of objective wins that happen when there's concordance, but we have these other things that happen, which is higher levels of trust, kind of better adherence to recommendations, to medication, to protocols, and kind of an improved relationship with the healthcare system. And I think that those things are especially important for certain communities in this country that have historically, had issues with trust, and reasonably so, with our healthcare system and with our research community. So very specifically, the African American and Black communities here in the United States, and our Native and Indigenous populations. You know, so we can think of examples like the Tuskegee experiment, Henrietta Lacks, et cetera, for sort of, you know, the notable famous reasons why certain communities, you know, might have issues with trust with the healthcare system. But I mean, I think that there's lots and lots of sort of personal and family examples as well. So when we have concordance, meaning we have somebody from our community, from our background as our healthcare provider, the literature overwhelmingly shows that the results are better, the actual objective results are better, but the trust in the healthcare system improves as well. The rub here is, as you mentioned, we just don't have enough racial and ethnic minorities in our healthcare system as providers and especially as physicians. So we have to think about how do we make up this gap in concordance until we can actually improve those numbers in the ranks of the health profession.
So very true. Dr. Robinson, I'm going to kind of go on a slight point here, which is to kind of examine the issue just of racism overall. There was an editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2018 based on Mayo Clinic patient surveys showing a bias against Black doctors from white patients. Did those results from this particular perspective surprise you, and has it changed any way that you practice medicine yourself?
No, unfortunately, the results did not surprise me. You know, I've had the experience of patients saying to me, no, thank you, I don't want to see a black doctor. Oh, and, you know, that was wow. As soon as I walked into the room. So before they knew anything about me, before I'd opened my mouth, before I'd shown them that I could provide really excellent care to them, you know, we certainly know that there are inherent biases against black people in general in this country just because of the color of our skin. So we think about racial profiling, people are driving, to being followed around when we're shopping, to the health profession. And for some particularly non-minority patients, their initial impression is that black physicians are incompetent or second-rate physicians. Therefore, the low patient experience scores are likely, I would imagine, just a manifestation of these biases. But I'll tell you that early in my training, I realized that patients and family members, particularly in the emergency department, appeared to be very surprised to see me when they were expecting to see a neurologist. And so I learned that immediately after I introduced myself and told them why I was there, I added this other line that said, I know I'm not exactly who you're expecting to see. And that was often met with a little nervous laughter, but I think it touched on the topic of the fact that people are not used to seeing black doctors, were anticipating seeing a black doctor, and may not have been very pleased to see a black doctor from the outset. Now, of course, people Google me, and so then they walk in, and they're not as surprised to see me. But no, those results don't surprise me, unfortunately, just because of the state of our country.
And thank goodness for Google, right?
Yes.
Dr. Reddy, you know, I am a Latino doctor, and I've heard a lot of conversations pertaining to this issue of implicit bias in our healthcare system. Those are kind of complex words. What is implicit bias, and what do you do to kind of overcome it?
Yeah, so implicit bias or unconscious bias really refers to the biases that are happening in our brain and in our consciousness that we're not necessarily aware of, right? We don't necessarily control those biases. They tend to be a reflection of our experiences, what we've been taught, what we've been exposed to. And when I say what we've been exposed to, I mean, that can come from what we've, you know, heard around the dinner table growing up, what the norm was, what the sort of cultural thoughts were in the towns or the cities or the communities we grew up in. But importantly, also what we are constantly being fed from sources like the media. So what do we see in movies? What do we see, you know, on television? What do we hear in the news, et cetera? So all of that together, you know, develops this way that we might automatically think about, in this context, about particular communities, about particular people that look a certain way, that speak a certain way, that come from a certain background. And what's important about implicit or unconscious biases are that, you know, often they're not what we would want to think. So they're not what we would, you know, like to represent ourselves as. They tend to be sort of automatic, and they happen a lot of times in high stress situations when we don't really have a moment to sort of say, okay, hold on, that's not what I should be thinking. That's not what I should be assuming. And when we think about high stress situations, I mean, gosh, medicine and healthcare, and Dr. Robinson just mentioned the ER, as those are great examples of high stress situations where you're making very quick decisions. And what we know about unconscious and implicit bias in healthcare is that, you know, there's documented evidence in the literature supports that healthcare providers, physicians, you know, are human beings, of course, right? We're all human beings, and we all have biases. And those biases are coming out in the way that we are treating patients, speaking to patients, what we're prescribing patients, and assumptions that are being made about patients, and to the detriment, by the way, of patients and of healthcare outcomes. So it's great that there's so much of a magnifying glass lately on the idea of unconscious bias, implicit bias. I think, you know, the tougher part is overcoming them, but the first step is acknowledging that it's real, that we all have them. And then, you know, working through sort of where do these ideas come from? Where do these concepts come from? And then how do we become more informed about the communities and people that we have these biases towards in order to kind of help check ourselves, right? And it's a process. It's a process of evolution. But the first step is recognizing that they exist. And I just want to add that while we often talk about biases from physicians and healthcare providers towards patients, as Dr. Robinson just mentioned, you know, it goes the other way too. And patients have biases towards their providers as well. And that obviously impacts the healthcare environment as well.
That's a very helpful definition, and I appreciate that. Dr. Robinson, you kind of referenced another study about concordance, and that's come up. There was a study out of Oakland in 2019 that suggested that black men were more likely to follow or access more prevention or preventative care if their doctor was also black like them. Do you see this like matching up ethnicities as a possible or even realistic solution?
I don't think so, because it's just not realistic for every black person, in particular in the United States, to see a black physician, given the known supply and demand mismatch. But because black physicians and minority physicians may be more likely to return to urban communities to practice medicine. These physicians, I think, if placed appropriately, can offer a better ratio of black physician to black patient. Now, the other thought is that if we could do a better job really incentivizing minority physicians to return to these communities as well, with providing better pay for people who are pursuing primary care practices, that might help. I think right now there's a financial deterrent, certainly for minorities to practice primary care, and there's an incentive to pursue more highly compensated specialty care, which further limits this access to communities of color. But given, I think, the limitations in the number of black and minority physicians in the country, we have an opportunity to really ensure that the entire healthcare system and all of healthcare professionals are trained to provide really culturally appropriate care. And we all should be well-versed in health disparities as well.
Dr. Reddy, Dr. Robinson just pointed out it may not be very realistic to match up the numbers. So from a policy perspective, what are the solutions?
Yeah, you know, I think what's really important here is while, you know, we've been speaking a lot about concordance, right, the similarity between providers and patients, it's important to note that in order to help bridge these gaps in trust, in adherence, in understanding between the provider and their patient, the provider does not absolutely have to come from your background, but what's important is that they do need to understand your background and understand your culture and understand how those things might impact as a patient, how they might impact the way that you think of, you know, an illness, of a disease, of the treatment. So becoming kind of more, not just culturally competent, but culturally humble, which means understanding that I need to understand, right? Can actually improve care between discordant providers and patients as well. So, you know, physicians and healthcare providers that don't come from your background can also become more knowledgeable, especially as we have a, you know, rapidly diversifying country, rapidly diversifying state like Florida. It's really critical that physicians in general and healthcare providers in general are more knowledgeable about cultural differences, but also sort of systemic barriers, racism, inequities that are facing their patient population so that they can help serve them better. And I would say a really important step there is educating and new kind of education programs for existing physicians and providers, but also, you know, what something that I'm very proud to be a part of, which is educating the providers of our future. I teach courses in unconscious bias and, you know, health disparities and policy to medical students at the Mayo Clinic School of Medicine. And I think that's an you know, kind of foundational step is really changing the way our future providers think and see their role in this space.
So such a great point and so important to be teaching all of this to all of our future healthcare providers. We have a couple of questions from our listeners from Facebook page. Dr. Robinson, Rowan, a listener from Neptune Beach, had a question, and specifically as a palliative care doctor that is involved in end-of-life care, does race or healthcare diversity play any role in good end-of-life medical care?
Well, thank you for that question. And I think before I start, I'll mention that we know that minorities, African-Americans, Latinos, are less likely to pursue advanced care planning or this process of discussing end-of-life wishes when compared to Caucasians. And so it's well documented that there are known, I think, and understandable barriers to thinking about palliative care and hospice care in these communities, one of which is mistrust. Dr. Reddy mentioned earlier about the Tuskegee experiment and Henrietta Lack. I think there are also earlier examples, such as removing slaves from the grave and learning anatomy on them, or taking blacks into operating rooms and performing surgeries without anesthesia. So there is concern among these communities about some possible agenda to provide what is perceived as less aggressive and substandard care at the end of life, and that may preclude African Americans from engaging in discussions about palliative care, hospice care, and wanting what may be perceived to the medical profession as more aggressive care without any significant benefit. I think we also know that there's a decreased exposure to minorities about advanced directives in palliative care and hospice care, and so they're often unfamiliar with the process and lack kind of an understanding of what the options may be with regard to palliative and hospice care and the differences between the two. And then I have to mention spirituality. I'm a pastor's daughter, and so there is a strong belief, particularly in general in the Black community, that if people are people of faith, that whatever happens occurs because God allowed it to happen, including disease, and kind of through him, also miracles can happen. And so often there's a thought that end-of-life care planning is not necessary and may interfere with God's plan. So broaching that topic is important. And the last thing I'll mention is that there's often a preference for communal decision-making versus autonomy. And we often talk about it's important to talk with your doctor and your family about your wishes so that your wishes can be honored at the end of life. And when the thought is that this is more about the community, more about my family, that sense of autonomy, which is more prevalent in non-minority communities, just isn't there. And so I think when we think about providing palliative care to minority populations, we have to think about some of these considerations.
This is so important, especially that community aspect. Dr. Reddy, a listener, Lisa from Amelia Island, asked on Facebook, what can be done policy-wise to grow the number of Black doctors in the United States?
Yeah, it's a great question, Lisa. You know, at the moment, what we are seeing sort of the most success in is really thinking about admissions policies, really thinking about the pipeline. And when I say the pipeline, it's not just about changing admissions policies for those that are applying, let's say, to medical school right now. It's really about thinking sort of upstream, you know, so working especially with underrepresented minority communities. So I'm specifically talking about Black communities and Latinx communities and Native American and Indigenous communities. All three are grossly underrepresented in medical school. And so really working kind of, you know, at the elementary school level, middle school level, high school level to, you know, to work with mentors, to work with STEM programs, et cetera, and really, you know, show mentorship, right? I mean, you know, there's a really famous quote, you can't be what you can't see. And I believe in that very strongly. So I think, you know, working on that pipeline at the beginning of the pipeline to get kids interested, engaged in science, in medicine, and to, you know, what Dr. Robinson said is really important. She was at an Ivy League college, and her advisor did not advise her to go to medical school. You know, we need to also work with those that are making decisions and advising young people and students, really, to really help push and enable underrepresented minorities to be able to enter these fields. And, you know, from an admissions perspective, many schools around the country, whether it is at an undergraduate level, medical school level, are really looking at more holistic admissions processes. So, you know, not just looking straight at the MCAT and GPA pieces, but looking at the whole applicant, which is incredibly important for underrepresented minorities because there are many pieces to their story and life experiences often that would make them a phenomenal providers, right? And especially in treating patients from their own community, but also that are really important to consider in their admissions process. And so I think that, you know, more policies at organizational levels that encourage the holistic admissions process, but also looking at that earlier in the pipeline piece is incredibly important in helping to diversify our healthcare workforce.
Well, we're going to leave it with that. I want to thank both you, Dr. Robinson, and you, Dr. Reddy, for your thoughts and your time. Those were fantastic, thoughts that you shared with us, and we really appreciate it. Later, we're going to discuss the increasing number of nurse practitioners and physician assistants seeing patients today. But up next, we're going to talk to a local patient to hear their perspective on what the experts just said. We'll be right back.
According to Australian researchers, people touch their own face an average of 23 times per hour, with almost half of these touches involving their mouth, nose, or eyes, the easiest way for germs to enter our bodies.
Welcome back. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which will examine where and how healthcare intersects with your life. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a local neurologist, and thanks for listening. Joining us now with a patient's perspective on whether or not your healthcare provider needs to look like you in order to receive better care is Sheila Collins, who lives here in Jacksonville. Ms. Collins, I'm going to start with the same questions that I asked our doctors. Does gender and racial diversity matter to you in healthcare?
You know, that's such an important question. And I guess I would say that it matters to me on a broad level, because I really think that to the extent possible, diversity of the patient of the medical care population should reflect the diversity of our patient population. But on a more personal level, really other attributes to me matter more.
So let me ask you, kind of delve into that. If you go ahead and book an appointment for medical care, do you ask for specific gender or race in some situations?
No, I don't. Because the attributes that matter to me as a patient are clinical competence and empathy. And I think you can find those in all sorts of cohorts, whether a sexual orientation or race or gender. And I think you can find the lack of those in the same populations. But I do have an exception. I feel more comfortable with a female gynecologist. Sure. I've had both male and female, and I just have a higher comfort level with the female. So in those cases, if possible, I express a preference for a female gynecologist. Otherwise, I'm just looking for people with those attributes that I value, clinical competence and empathy.
No, it makes perfect sense, and I completely get that, and I've heard that aspect very much before about with more sensitive areas or specialties. Let me ask you, have you ever been in a situation where you walked into the medical appointment and the person seeing you was different, maybe a different ethnicity? You mentioned gender a moment ago, or a different faith or political bent. Did those differences ever seem to impact your medical care in your own opinion or experience?
Well, you know, over the years, my physicians and caregiver folks have been fairly diverse, you know, different genders, different races. It's never been an issue for me in any case. But I am going to share one area that I still feel a little queasy about that I did request a change. And that was when my long-term internist retired, and I was assigned a very young, just out of residency, internist. And I went to that appointment. She was a young female, reminded me very much of my daughter. And I just didn't feel comfortable. And I then requested a change to somebody who, as it turned out, was a little bit more mature. I'm sure that young female physician had all the competency needed, but I didn't feel comfortable. So I guess age in that case perhaps was something I reacted to. Now, I do have to say I felt good that I approached her directly. I explained my concerns, and she was very gracious about me transferring. But that was one time where I just didn't feel comfortable.
No, and I'm listening to that. Maturity is such a huge aspect, and age does play a role in some of this, doesn't it?
It does.
It strikes me, and we heard this brought up, I believe, by Dr. Reddy in our last segment, that it's the concept of trust that seems to be the most important or particularly important when you're considering the role of how gender or race in healthcare can impact you when you're sitting in the exam room. What do you think would make a doctor or provider gain your trust regardless of their differences?
Well, you know, the first thing is, greet me by my name and look me in the eye when I'm talking. And I think that is maybe more difficult now with electronic medical records and increasing technology. But see me. Just really see me. And see the totality of me as an individual with perhaps multiple healthcare issues to be addressed, not just as that
chief complaint, you know, the old the gallbladder in room 42 kind of syndrome. But it really boils down to just mutual respect, that caregiver or provider sees me as a full person and respects me for coming in front of him or her.
Such a huge, important point, seeing you as the person. I guess that is the real message from all of this. I was kind of curious with regards to our previous guests. They were all talking about racial diversity within the healthcare workforce. There was a lot of focus on that aspect. I was kind of given a sense, I think you've answered this, but does it matter what that ethnicity or race is? Does it stop anyone if you walk in the door or your family sees someone of a different ethnicity in terms of their care for you or your family?
It certainly wouldn't stop either myself or any member of my family, but I think it brings up a broader point, and that is, you know, you can only have diversity in healthcare to the extent that you've got a good pipeline of people coming in and being mentored and seeing that that option is a possibility for them. So I think to the extent that we want caregivers and providers to reflect the greater diversity in the nation, we've got to have a better pipeline. And that also includes training. You know, one of my friends, an African-American friend, only wants to see a black dermatologist because they believe that skin conditions sometimes look different on African or present differently on African-American skin. And they're not confident that a perhaps a Caucasian provider might always recognize those. So we've also got to make sure that, you know, when we train people, that those training materials and the patients that they see during training are as diverse as possible.
Ms. Collins, I just want to thank you for sharing your thoughts and your opinions with us. And I really appreciate your time today.
That's great. It's an important question. Thanks so much.
You betcha. We'll be right back. Welcome back. At the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, major changes were needed to increase provider capacity to handle the sheer number of patients with the virus. Both here in Florida as well as nationwide, policies were relaxed to allow for nurse practitioners and physician assistants to practice more independently, assuming they met certain requirements. The number of nurse practitioners and physician assistants are expected to continue to rise, and odds are that you've probably seen one at your local clinic, hospital, or wherever you get your health care. But is it the same care as that provided by your doctor? Dr. Elaine Bourne, Executive Director of the Student Health Center and faculty member of the Nurse Practitioner Program at the Jacksonville University's Kegwin School of Nursing, joins us now for a closer look. Dr. Bourne, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. So let's start off with the basics. What is a nurse practitioner and what can they do?
Well, a nurse practitioner is a registered nurse who has completed either a master's or a doctorate degree and has advanced didactic and clinical education beyond their professional training as a nurse. Nurse practitioners are trained in the areas of either family medicine, or you could say as a family nurse practitioner, and they really focus on primary care type services throughout the lifespan, we say from birth to death. Or they can be trained as an acute care nurse practitioner focusing more on ICU management of patients, those who are more acutely or critically ill, or maybe they're trained as a women's health or a psych mental health nurse practitioner that focuses in on managing patients who have mental health disorders. And what a nurse practitioner can do is really dependent upon the nurse practitioner's area of specialization, of those areas that I was just talking about. Also, the state in which they work facility bylaws, such as a hospital or a nursing home where they're going to be working. But in general, nurse practitioners can obtain medical histories, can perform physical exams, interpret labs and x-rays, diagnosis an illness, and develop treatment plans. So generally speaking, nurse practitioners can manage a patient's overall care.
No, that's pretty clear by the way that you just described the scope of that practice. I mentioned in the intro that there has been a relaxation of some of these requirements as part of the COVID-19 pandemic. Do you have any specifics as to why they've been allowed to expand their practice during this time?
Well, particularly, we need to open up healthcare to patients. And you know, when you think about the scope of practice for nurse practitioners, it's very broad. And we need to be able to provide services to patients. And it's something that nurse practitioners can do. So let's open up that opportunity to provide these services to patients.
Let me flip the question around. You told me about everything that a nurse practitioner can do. Is there anything that a nurse practitioner cannot do?
Well, that's really going to be dependent upon the state laws. You know, some states allow nurse practitioners to practice independently to their full scope of training, while others require a collaborative agreement, or what you could say is a supervisory relationship with a physician in order for the nurse practitioner to provide patient care. You know, actually in 50 states and D.C., nurse practitioners can prescribe medications, but in 29 states, nurse practitioners either have restricted or reduced practice, meaning that a state law actually limits their ability in one or more ways to practice to their full scope of training.
Wow. You know, there's been so much emphasis on telemedicine, and it's such a huge growth area just because of the current pandemic. How has this impacted nurse practitioners specifically? Are they seeing more patients this way?
Oh, sure, absolutely. You know, it's just like you said, it's really impacted all of us as healthcare providers as a result of this pandemic. We've seen something completely different in the United States. You know, we've really been forced to embrace telemedicine or telehealth to provide the needed healthcare services to our patients. And, you know, it's really opened our eyes to the services that can actually be offered remotely. It's literally taking us beyond the confines of our office spaces, our clinics, our building, and shown us the services that we can actually provide outside of those buildings. So when you consider the predicted shortage of primary care physicians, nurse practitioners can actually use this experience and what they've learned from over the last several months with telemedicine to relieve the shortage of primary care physicians and increase access to care, particularly for those patients who are in underserved areas or in rural areas, or the senior adult population who can't leave their homes. You know, the use of telemedicine has also impacted the education of nurse practitioners. We've all recognized the need to incorporate telemedicine into the training of nurse practitioner and students to really ensure they understand there's laws and regulations and policies behind telemedicine, as well as billing and reimbursement. You know, this pandemic has really changed the way healthcare has been delivered in our country for years. And it's something that I believe is here to stay. And telemedicine is going to become a big part of the way nurse practitioners continue to offer services to our patients in the future.
You know, that's a very good point. And I kind of want to put a very more personal thing. One of the things I've observed on rare occasion, and this is, you know, from a personal standpoint, sometimes I'm called in because the patient says they walk in and they see that they're going to see the nurse practitioner. And then they go to the front desk and ask, I want to see the doctor and not the nurse practitioner. So I'm kind of curious, what would you suggest to our listeners out there or to those who kind of have that vibe or give that perspective? What would you tell that patient or their family if they make that type of request?
Yeah, you know, I love this question. You know, and that's something that I'd actually tell the patient and the family. I tell them that's okay. You know, the issue is going to be dependent upon the patient. You know, some patients are going to have a better provider-patient relationship with a physician, while other patients have a better relationship with a nurse practitioner. There's, you know, there's really several variables that come into play with this issue. You know, is it the diagnosis, the chronicity of the disease, the age of the patient, the prior experience with a physician or a nurse practitioner? All of these things need to be considered as to why the patient only wants to see one type of provider. You know, while some patients say, I only want to see the physician, others say, I only want to see the nurse practitioner. The nurse practitioner takes more time with me. They explain things in a way I can understand my diagnosis or illness. So I guess what I'm really trying to say here is that's okay, but what's most important is that the provider-patient relationship results in a positive clinical outcome for the patient.
That's so important. And I just want to say thank you so much for joining us today to share your perspectives. This has been incredibly helpful.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Up next, a discussion with an alternative holistic provider on what we can do to keep ourselves healthy at home. We'll be right back.
According to the National Institute of Aging, the one diet that has shown promise in the prevention of Alzheimer's disease is the Mediterranean DASH diet, which emphasizes whole grains, seafood, and incorporates ways to control high blood pressure, an important risk factor for Alzheimer's disease.
Welcome back. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which will examine where and how healthcare intersects with your life. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a local neurologist, and thanks for listening. With so many of us at home during the COVID pandemic, there's been a renewed focus on what we can do naturally and on our own to truly stay healthy. Megan Weigel, a holistic alternative nurse practitioner with First Coast Integrative Medicine, joins us now with some important tips. Dr. Weigel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Dr. Servin. It's great to be here.
It's a pleasure. Well, let's start off with explaining that term that we see all the time, and I bet our listeners always have questions. What does integrative and complementary medicine mean, and how is this different from any other medicine?
You know, I love having the opportunity to explain this because I think there's a lot of misconception around integrative medicine, which is different than complementary medicine. So I've practiced integrative medicine and I'm fellowship trained, and that means that I practice our conventional Western medical paradigm and a complementary and alternative paradigm together. So it means that I'm still practicing in an evidence-based manner, and the recommendations that I'm giving to people come with safety in mind for their medical conditions, for the medications that they're taking. And the difference between that and complementary medicine or complementary and alternative medicine is that sometimes people use complementary and alternative medicine without going to a conventional provider anymore. So the integrative term kind of brings it all together, and it says, hey, when I take a look at you, I'm going to look at you from both perspectives and give you opportunities to heal yourself from both sciences.
I love that. Now, why do some patients prefer to work with practitioners that offer this more holistic approach?
You know, I actually looked that up to see if anyone had done any research about that specifically. And there's actually research from the cancer literature. And I think this, you know, to make a broad statement, I think it could probably be extrapolated to general population. But people report dissatisfaction with the conventional system. And some of that may come from sort of a conspiracy theory about pharmaceutical companies and why haven't we found cures for certain things, which, you know, I don't subscribe to those theories. Also, people are dissatisfied not with the provider relationship, but with what our healthcare system has come down to, in the sense that I have 15 problems to discuss with my primary care provider and I have 10 minutes. And so typically in integrative medicine or complementary and alternative medicine, the relationship between the patient and provider is a major focus, and there are not time constraints. There's also more of a focus on a personal journey. So a person with a disease may recognize that there's a significant relationship between, say, stress and the manifestations of his disease. And so he may seek a different type of medicine to try to get to the root cause of his stress. I'd say with that most, not all, but most integrative medicine providers, complementary and alternative medicine providers, most of those services aren't covered by insurance. And that is why there's the luxury of time that people enjoy.
Such a huge, important point, because that payer and payment is always a huge driver in all of this.
Yep.
You know, the pandemic has made everyone so incredibly anxious these days. What simple tips can you offer our listeners that aren't necessarily medicinal that can help keep people calm and healthy at home?
Absolutely. I would love to give some of those. The first thing I'd say is just return to what's simple and important in your life. I was talking about this morning on my bike ride. You know, we had this COVID shutdown and we thought, well, this is going to simplify our lives, but it actually gave us more time to sit around and think about all the things we could do at home. So I encourage people to just return to very simple things, create rituals around cooking and meal time, practice good sleep hygiene, eat mindfully, go outside, you know, sit in your yard and look at nature. I encourage people to use meditation apps to even get in a 5-minute meditation or guided meditation mindfulness period each day. And then I love to teach the 4-7-8 breath. Are you familiar with that?
Why don't you describe it for our listeners?
Okay, 19 seconds. Basically, you're going to complete your exhale, and then you're going to close your mouth and inhale through your nose to a count of 4. Pause at the top to a count of 7, and then exhale through your mouth to a count of 8. 19 seconds, incredible benefit for tampering down your nervous system. You can do it at a stoplight. You can do it when you're on the phone with your mother-in-law if you need a little break. It's very, very helpful for bringing calm to anxiety in the moment.
Great advice for upcoming holidays. Question that I have to get in there in our remaining time. So much emphasis on CBD. Have you found it helpful for your patients? So what about this agent?
Yeah, so in a nutshell, CBD is one of the things that I probably use the least. And the reason is because it is incredibly expensive to get a good quality product. So a good quality product ensures that it's not adulterated with THC or other products, that every drop that you take has the same dose, and the manufacturing process is expensive. And so if you're looking at a good quality CBD oil, you're looking at $200 to $300 a month for that product, and it's just very expensive. I do believe that CBD has the potential to be used as an anxiolytic, an anti-inflammatory, maybe adjunctively for chronic pain or people trying to decrease their use of alcohol. But when someone tells me that they took CBD oil for the first time and it alleviated their anxiety, I think it might be more of a placebo effect. That being said, if they can do that and safely get off of a benzodiazepine, then they're probably better off, right? If you can have a drop of CBD instead of a Xanax three times a week.
Right.
But I use CBD as more of a homeostatic agent. So something that really helps your nervous system kind of come back to a neutral place instead of angry firing all the time. And that takes time. So when I use it, I tell people that, you know, 4 to 6 weeks before they notice a difference in things with a really good high quality product.
Right. I want to say thank you so much, Dr. Weigel. We're out of time, and I just really appreciate you joining your thoughts. This is incredibly helpful.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
Well, that's our program for today. If you missed anything, you can catch the rebroadcast tomorrow at 9 p.m. or listen to the full program at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests and social media participants. Our senior producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Our associate producer is Catherine Hobbs. Have questions or comments for our upcoming show on how the holidays can impact your health or an idea for a future show? Call us at 904-358-6362 or tweet me at Jay Servin. Send an email to health@wjct.org. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed your holiday and keep in touch.
This program is sponsored in part by the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatments, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Epilepsy Foundation Florida leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies to stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com/Florida to find out how to get involved today.